Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Hi, we're really fortunate to be able to welcome along today our guest, Jan Banning, who is an internationally acclaimed conceptual photographer artist born in the Netherlands to parents of Dutch East Indian heritage. Jan describes his work as artivism and uses striking visual images in efforts to effect change. His documentary photo projects cover an apparently broad range of subjects, although often speak to big socio-political themes of power and oppression, injustice, poverty, and the impact of colonialism and war. Thus far, he's published 14 photo books, and his work has been shown in 80 solo exhibitions, including in some of the most prestigious galleries and museums in the world. His photos are featured in innumerable newspapers and publications, including The Guardian, The Independent, The Sunday Times, The New Yorker, Time, and Newsweek. I'm really lucky to have met Jan before when I invited him into the FENS unit to speak to the men about his work, and the men were really struck by his photographs of men who had been forced labourers working on the Burmese railway, which evoked discussions about enslavement, trauma and resilience. And for us today, this represents a really unusual podcast because we're also trialling the use of visuals at the same time in the hope that we're able to simultaneously display some of Jan's work on YouTube to accompany this podcast. So really delighted to welcome along Jan today, who has a forthcoming exhibition which is focused on the case of an incarcerated woman, Christina Boyer, who's been incarcerated for 28 years. So delighted to have you here today, Jan. Thanks very much for coming along.
Well, thanks for having me, Naomi.
Hi, Jan. I'm very pleased to meet you. And I've been reading up on your background and terribly interested to read that one of your influences was the Mask of Anarchy. And the line within that, I met murder on the way, he wore a mask like Castlereagh, was a rhyme that really resonated with me when I was younger. And of course, I've always remembered it. And of course, one of your other influences that you mention is Kathy Kollwitz, whose museum I've visited many times in Berlin, one of my most favourite artists. I used to have a drawing of hers of a mother holding her child in my consulting room for many years. So I'm very pleased to meet you.
Well, likewise, David. Yeah, that's an interesting coincidence. Yeah. Yeah.
So can you tell us something about your latest exhibition and how you came to be inspired to tell Christina's story?
Yes, I was working on a project called Law and Order, which came out as a book and was shown as an exhibition starting in 2015. In which I was comparing criminal justice systems in four different countries, in France, in Colombia, in Uganda, and in the United States. And in the context of that, I struggled to get permission to prisons. As you can imagine, that wasn't easy, but finally I managed to get permission to visit five prisons in Georgia. The US state of Georgia. And one of those five was the Pulaski State Prison, which is a prison, big prison for women. And what I did was I set up a studio, a photo studio inside the prison. And for 3 days, I photographed women. All in all, I think about some 80 women. The purpose was, let's say, visually to photograph these people as I would photograph, well, as I would photograph either one of you or my girlfriend or whoever. So a beautifully lit portrait without any judgment. And the reasoning behind it is that it's my strong belief that also we, as supposedly good citizens, could, in different circumstances and maybe with different upbringing or whatever, different mental state, could just as well be criminals or commit crimes. So I wanted to bridge that gap. And the other thing I wanted to do was to find out what one can come across when doing a search on the internet, because I had understood by then that the internet, the presence of names and information about people, could be a strong blockade in their reintegration into society if they ever got out. So I tried to find whatever I could of a number of these women, I think about 45. And one of the last ones I investigated was a woman called Christina Boyer. And there's quite a lot of information about her on the internet. Not necessarily so much under her name, Christina Boyer, but more under the name of Tina Resch, which was her, well, how do you call that? Her previous name, let's put it like that. So I read all of that and I thought the whole case against her was quite fishy. I have to say that the Department of Corrections in Georgia allowed me to photograph these women, but they did not allow any conversations. And there was actually somebody in the back of the room checking on that. So I could ask the name, the date of birth, and the length of the sentence and the date of the start of the sentence. That was it. So based on that, I put myself behind a computer like a, let's say, as an employer, who gets a who has an interview with this person, and then we'll see. We do a background check. So in the case of Christina Boyer, it was clear that she had a life plus 20 year sentence, life with the possibility of parole. She was convicted of killing her 3-year-old daughter on April the 14th, 1992. And it struck me because, of course, a woman killing her own daughter, a 3-year-old daughter, is something that you start wondering about. What happened? What brings a mother to do that if she's done it? And the more I read on the internet, the more doubt was cast on whether she even did that. And then the tragedy of it all hit home. The huge likelihood that she was wrongfully incarcerated after losing her 3-year-old child and not even committing that murder herself. So that drove me to investigate a lot more and a lot more. And by now I have like a, I think, half a meter high stack of documents. Basically, I have all the documents. The autopsy report of the daughter, Amber, she was called. Transcripts of the police interviews with her and her boyfriend, who was the only one present when the girl died. Transcript of the court cases, psychiatric reports, over the years, I'm saying over the years because I photographed her and these other ladies 8 years ago in 2013, over the years, we have started to exchange emails. And that's become a huge stack also. I recently counted them, and the two of us together have exchanged like 1,250 emails now. So that's how I got strongly involved.
Thank you very much. Christina's story seems somewhat captivating, because in many ways she could be representative of so many people in the US prison system, don't you think?
Yes, absolutely. I consider the the book that I'm making, where she's given huge support, and the exhibition, which is going to be shown first early next year in the Dutch Photo Museum, an exhibition which will be under both our names, because I consider her to be an important co-author, is supposed to be a case study of, indeed, typical for how the US criminal justice system works. And let me just mention a few things that are very representative, I think. If we look at our own image of the American criminal justice system based on what we see on TV, in movies, beautiful courtroom, lots of wood there, dark wood, and there's the jury and the judge, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that only applies to 5% of the cases, of the criminal cases. And 95% ends in a plea bargain, which is logical because the US is the biggest incarcerator in the world, and they have the biggest incarceration rate of all countries. So if all those people would have to be taken to court and there would be an actual trial with jury, et cetera, I think probably the whole financial system of the US would collapse. So the way it works is basically prosecutor comes up with a very heavy sentence that he's aiming at, and then you offer the suspect a lighter sentence in exchange for this plea deal. And that's what also happened in Christina's case. So she was never really tried. Another, I think, very typical thing which is related to this is that, of course, most of the suspects are indigent people, are poor, so they can't afford a lawyer of their own. So they get a pro bono lawyer. And a lot of these lawyers are overworked, unmotivated, or simply bad lawyers. So she and many other people have very little confidence in their own defense. So that makes them more likely to accept a plea deal. So those are two, I think, very typical things.
Mm. Yeah, that's very powerful, actually, Jan. And I'm thinking that the press also rely on good visual images to tell their stories. Can you say something about the role of the press in criminal justice and how you reflect this within your work?
Yeah, let me show a few photographs there. So let's see, here we go. And then good. Well, we've seen that one. Oh, sorry, this is a bit chaos. Yeah. So let me say a few words about the visual side of this. Let me first start to talk about the role of the media. I photographed all relevant pages of the regional newspaper. As I said, the death of her daughter Amber occurred in Carroll County, which is, let's say, some 60 miles to the west of Atlanta, the capital of Georgia. So it's countryside. And there is a county newspaper, which is called the Times Georgian. And they published, I think, about 85 pages related to this story.
Ik zie geen 80 pages related to this story heet. Je zou even.
Shut up. sorry, the computer interferes. So beginning with her and the boyfriend being arrested, then mentioning that the public prosecutor is going to go for the death sentence, and there are related topics such as the fact that this all happened shortly before the elections of local officials. And you have to take into account that in many American states, the public prosecutors, the sheriffs, the judges are elected. And now, but even more so, I think, in the 1990s, when this happened, there was a strong, tough on crime atmosphere. So if you wanted to be elected, you certainly had to make it clear that you were going to be tough on crime. And of course, all the more so shortly before the elections. So there is a relation, I think, between the position of the DA and the sheriff and the judge, which we can never prove. But in general terms, this has in several parts of the US indeed been proven, I mean, statistically speaking, that these, for example, the judges in the year of their election are more likely to go for the death penalty. So there's those articles. And what you see is kind, you basically see how quickly the hysteria builds up in the media. Who do we get to hear? We mainly get to hear the DA and the police. The two suspects, Christina and her then boyfriend, David, they of course, there's a lot of publicity about both of them, but there's a strong difference in the sense that Christina was an outsider. Christina came from Ohio and had only been living in Carroll County for a couple of months, whereas the boyfriend was the son of two well-respected nurses in Carrollton, which is a small city, lots of people know them. So the starting point, of course, was, let's say, didn't look too good for the boyfriend. Briefly, what happened is on that fatal day, April 14, 1992, around 12:30, Christina leaves the house where Amber is left with the boyfriend. There had been a few falls and bruises, etc., in the previous days, but when Christina checked with her daughter, who normally was very outspoken, the daughter said, "I fell, mommy." And on another occasion again, she said, "I fell with my face, rocks in my face," and the explanation of the boyfriend was she fell off small stairs with her head on the in the gravel. So it seemed to make sense. Anyway, I mean, it seemed to make sense. She didn't suspect that the boyfriend had abused the child. And until today, we don't know if he did. Speculation. Anyway, Christina leaves the house just after 12:30. And when she comes back around 6 o'clock, the boyfriend is kind of panicking. She drives up the driveway and there's the boyfriend and he's saying, "I can't wake Amber up." And she goes to the bedroom and finds her daughter all blue and not breathing and no heartbeat. And they drive to the hospital and that's where the police gets involved. So you would expect, and indeed that was the situation, that in the beginning there was more suspicion pointed towards David, the boyfriend, then towards her. But you see this change rather quickly. And the police seems to play a role in it, but also the media play a role in it. She very quickly starts to be described as a bad mother. There had been some 8 years earlier, some strange events when she was still living in Ohio, paranormal stuff, media attention. And of course, in the Bible Belt, that's not necessarily a good thing. It's, let's say, more likely to be related to the devil than to God. So that didn't give an all too good impression. She was an unwed mother. Then it turned out that she had been, let's say, posing in a sexual video of some amateur in Carrollton. So she must be a horrible woman. And you see the whole suspicion move in her direction. So to put it briefly, I think there's certainly an aspect, a strong aspect, of being tried by media. And yeah, the whole media treatment was I think, pretty superficial. They didn't delve into things. Let me show a few of those photographs, if that works. Yes, it does. So visually speaking, I focused on these articles, but for context, I also showed the other parts of the newspaper, and we still have to work a bit on the contrast, et cetera, et cetera. And the whole style, the whole approach, the visual approach is let's say, there's an association with the film noir. Okay, well, that's, is there anything else you would want to discuss about the media?
Well, I was just reflecting, I mean, she looks so young in that photo, doesn't she? But I was also reflecting how much kind of social norms have changed over time. So the being a unmarried mother, for instance, counting against her at that point in time, where actually things changed quite a lot in terms of society. My guess is, I mean, the way we view women is women are held up to different standards to men. So I guess the posing in the soft porn magazine would still have been held against her, but some of the harshness of how she was treated will have been reflective of that era, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think so. Yes. I also think that the societies there have become less closed. There's more influx of people from outside. So it's probably more enlightened than it was at the time.
I was going to question that slightly, because one of the things I usually do, you know, before I go to sleep is on my tablet, flick through the headline pages of many of the daily papers coming out the following day. And you could well imagine some of our newspapers like the Express and the Mail, the Star, having similar kinds of headlines as we see here. Although, as you said, there is a particular film noirish quality about many of these headlines, which is more American than British, I should say.
Yeah. Yes. Well, of course. I mean, it's all relative. It's still countryside. It's still I'm probably not supposed to say that, but a bit backward, even if you compare it to Atlanta, for example. Look at the political situation at the moment. You saw that Georgia suddenly made a turn to, I wouldn't say to the left, but certainly to the Democrats. And the Republicans are kind of in panic to limit voting there, because it's going in the wrong direction from their point of view. So yeah, I think that has changed. On the other hand, this area, Carroll County, is still strongly Republican. And
But I guess the film noir effect of your photos kind of reverses that. I suppose what you're casting up is the morality of the press in terms of their involvement and how much power they've had to shape what happens to this woman, in a way where the press have focused on the morality of her conduct, but actually there's that thing about not throwing stones, isn't there?
Yes, I'm not sure what exactly the question is, but yeah, I think so. And of course, they used certain aspects. Eh? There is one headline saying sex, lies, and videotape when this sexual video came up. And then the whole atmosphere becomes something like as if she's a semi-porn star. This is, my goodness, I mean, this is one guy who in his private home films her with bare breasts. Well, how terrible is that? And certainly, how is that related to killing or not killing your daughter?
Yeah.
Well, I think we've got a member of the royal family who's had similar photos taken of her, actually. But, anyway.
Yeah.
What happened to her then partner, David?
So the DA decided to first handle Christina's case. As I said, she had I don't think necessarily a bad lawyer, but this lawyer had all in all 88 cases at the same time. And among them, at least one very high profile case, which also has most likely earned him a nice sum of money. So he wasn't too motivated, meaning that in the about 1.5 or 2 years, he was supposed to be her lawyer. She met him 4 times. The second time, when she wanted to discuss the case, which was very shortly before the trial was supposed to open, ironically, on Halloween, it was supposed to open, he came up and told her that, no, there's no defense. I worked out a plea deal with the DA, and if you don't take that, I'm off. And of course, there's another aspect. A lot of poor people who are not, let's say, really brilliantly educated have little clue of how the justice system works. So in her perception, that meant that she would be alone in the courtroom without defense. The DA would ask for the death penalty, and she would immediately after judgment be taken out and put on the electric chair, which is not how it works, but hey, she didn't know. Anyway, so she took this plea deal, and well, I'll not get into the details of that, but it was a very absurd form of plea deal in which basically she said, I will... I'm not going to admit that I'm guilty. I didn't beat my daughter dead, but I accept the sentence. Strange thing. Anyway, so that was done. And then David was taken to court. And during his trial, which was 3 months after she took the plea deal, all kinds of things came to the surface, which cast strong doubts on her being guilty. To mention one thing, I think I said that she her sentence was life plus 20 years. The 20 years was for beating, mainly injuring her pancreas, obviously her daughter's pancreas. During David's trial, the medical specialist who reported this originally testified that while the pancreas, it would have healed by itself. There was nothing serious. Okay, so she gets 20 years extra for an injury which will heal by itself. So anyway, the final result is that David is sentenced to 20 years, not for murder, most likely because they already have somebody convicted of the murder, so that's been solved. So he's convicted for cruelty to children. And after 19 and a half years, he's been released. And he is now living in Carrollton again. He's been married and probably is keeping a low profile. He doesn't want to discuss this whole case with anyone. But he's free. He's been free since 2011. And as you rightly pointed out, Christina has been locked up now for over 29 years by now.
Thank you. Naomi?
Could you say something about the credibility of the professionals involved in a conviction as well? I mean, you've spoken about having a pro bono lawyer, but it sounds, I think from our conversations previously, it sounded like there were other questions about the credibility of some of the people that were involved in her case, like the judge.
Yes, you could say that. I mean, when I started to delve into that, I really didn't believe it. I thought if you would put this in a movie, people would say, come on, that's not credible. So let me try to remember at least most of these. It's almost undoable. The judge later on was forced to resign for, what's it called, judicial, let's say faults, but it was more like corruption. What else do we have? Yes, when Christina was taking this Alford plea, when she decided to take it, she was heavily medicated, which basically she didn't know. She thought she was getting antidepressants, but it turns out that what she got was antipsychotic medication and much too strong. The doctor who administered this medication was later on sentenced to, I think, 25 years for illegal distribution of prescription medicine. Then, after she had taken the plea, people managed to find money, found a second lawyer to do a habeas case. I don't know, is that something that you're familiar with?
No. Habeas corpus. It's not used very much here.
Yeah, basically it's trying to prove that she's wrongfully incarcerated. Let's put it like that. That's the simplest thing. She lost that. The second lawyer later on also ended up in prison for sex with minors. I think he's been convicted to 10 years. Or, you know, it becomes blurry after a while because there's so many. Several of the parole officers the parole board members who were judging on her parole were forced out of their role or even put in prison for different things. For example, one guy who was the chairman of the parole board and then became the commissioner of prisons in Georgia on one occasion entered a prison with a bunch of goons that started to smash up prisoners and blood all over the place. And in the end, the state of Georgia was convicted to paying damages to these prisoners. There's more, but I...
Well, it just seems so...
A list.
Well, that's it. It's really striking. It's, you know, and is this just kind of like a set of really improbable but unfortunate coincidences, or is that a reflection of the degree of corruption and rot within the system. And I suppose, is this something that's uniquely possible in America, or could you see this kind of thing happening in other countries?
That's a difficult question, Naomi, because I have been really absorbed by this case. I'm not a criminologist who specializes in the criminal justice system in the United States or elsewhere. And well, according to things I heard, for example, from a lawyer, a Dutch lawyer who's been active in Louisiana, it's not unusual, to put it, let's put it like that. It is and certainly was very much an old boys network, people protecting each other. And then every once in a while, they had the bad luck that some person with more integrity came into an important position, and then they got into trouble. I cannot really imagine that. Well, look, a lot of other people had to deal with these same persons. The judge, for example, this is not just because he was corrupt, that was the problem. The guy was known to take naps in court. I mean, how good a judge is that? What kind of an interpretation of your role is that? But I cannot really make a strong case in this.
That's fine, thank you. I was wondering how easy it's been to create a compelling visual experience when the person at the centre of the story is in prison.
Well, that's a good question, yeah. As you've seen, I portrayed her once, the photograph that we have shown at the beginning of the of this programme was made in prison. Since then, I have time and time again asked for permission to enter the prison again and to see her as a member of the media, with introductory letters of print media, as an artist with a letter of introduction of the Dutch Rijksmuseum, and it never worked. And finally, unfortunately, in late 2019, I found kind of a, let's call it a backdoor, so that I could visit her again. But certainly not with any equipment. There's no way I can photograph again. The Commissioner of Prisons, who at the time in 1993 gave me permission, has gone. There's another Commissioner of Prisons who seems to be much less, even less open. But it's not just that, it's also that normally I work in a documentary style. So let's say the existing reality is my starting point. But if you look at a case, at something that happened when I started more than 25 years ago, I mean, I started more than 25 years after the events, after 1992, 1994, when Amber was killed and the trial was ongoing, et cetera, et cetera. So much has changed that it doesn't make much sense. The apartment where Christina lived has been demolished. The trailer of her boyfriend where Amber died has gone, and there's a totally new trailer there. Many of the people involved have died and are not very keen on collaborating anyway. The buildings have changed. The hospital has been completely modernized. The jail has been completely rebuilt. So it seemed to me that there were only two options. One option was what we in Holland would call this approach of guilty places, where you go back, which you see, for example, in some photo series about the First World War, where people go to Verdun or to Somme or whatever, and there's a landscape and you see, well, I don't know, what, corn growing, or you see a farmer on a tractor, or you see nothing, and there's a field, and that's where the drama happened, but the photograph has zero drama. Which can be interesting, but I was kind of fed up with that approach. And certainly here I thought, that's nothing. And because, let's say, the aspect of subjectivity and objectivity is such a big thing here, we look at the newspapers where, well, what exactly is true, what is not true. We look at what was being said by the police, by the DA, and also, of course, what Christine herself says, although I very much tend to believe her and see her as a very honest person, it is subjective, obviously. So I thought maybe it makes sense to, for myself, to also give a subjective interpretation of things that happened. And also, that's basically the last part of this book. I'll show a bit of that. I invited Christina to add her subjective, to give her subjective input. And so shall we look at some of the images?
That would be great, yes, please.
Yeah. This. Why this doesn't work is always a mystery, of course. Oh, okay, there we go. Yep, well, this is a good example. Let's show this. Can you see it now?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can.
Good, good. So what you see here, I don't know how well you can see it here, but we have developed such a strong confidential relationship that she allowed me to first read and then also use pages from her diaries in the period between her arrest and the plea deal, provided that I show her the pages that I selected. So I've selected, I think 16 or so double pages from these, the 2.5 years diaries. And that's one of the inputs. So you're not going to read that now, but it gives you an idea, of course. Huh? And it's very moving. Actually, she's a good writer. Maybe not in the literary sense, but in few words, she can express things with a lot of impact. It's emotional, it's poetic, it can be philosophical, and it's very open. And you have to remember that, of course, these diaries were not meant to be read by anyone. So this is one of the two aspects of her subjectivity. I'll keep it to just one example. I also include some photographs from her private collections. And this for me is a very moving example. It's a Polaroid of her and her daughter, not so long before Amber died. And as you can see, Amber has been drawing on this. And one of the things that struck me and that I've incorporated in the whole series is the importance of the color pink, which of course is very much a young girl's color. And Amber was probably not the only one whose favorite color was pink, but she loved to wear pink. And even here you see that she's drawing with pink. So I use this color pink a lot in the whole series. But let's go to the interpretations that I mentioned. So what I did was partly, I mean, this is Amber's grave. And we've had a lot of correspondence about these photographs. Some of them are completely inspired by what Christina told me. And others, like this one, for example, I photographed again in this kind of film noirish style with lots of contrast between light and dark. And with every photograph that I made, I checked it with her. It's not like asking for permission, but I was curious because she is such a interesting woman. And maybe this is the right moment to say that although this whole project started based on pity and empathy, because it seemed so horrible to me that a woman has to first lose a child and then wrongfully be put in prison for that for decades. But through the years, she has become a much richer person for me. She has so much to say, so I wanted to have this exchange also. And here, for example, her interpretation, she's a very religious person, which I'm not. She was really grateful for this photograph because she said it's almost like the light of God is shining on the grave of Amber. And I thought that was very moving. Well, this here, so this is all, this, for example, is recreated. So what I did was I looked at the circumstances in the back garden of the where the original trailer was, where Amber died. And what you see here is also related to my research. So I also tried to figure out if maybe there had not been any murder at all. Because of the descriptions that everyone gave of the boyfriend, even Christina herself, she said, very laid back guy, very relaxed, very patient, which made me wonder, would such a person actually suddenly explode and kill a 3-year-old girl? That's strange. And by then it was clear to me that Christina couldn't have done it. Based on all kinds of research that I also did here in Holland and in Belgium, et cetera. I spoke to medical specialists. So I started to investigate, could it be that because of the falls on previous days, maybe there was a slow impact. And here, for example, one of the stories was that she fell off her tricycle and got the steering wheel in her stomach. And could it be that that was the cause of the pancreas injuries? So this photo was inspired by that. And the way I photographed it was inspired by the original backyard of the trailer. And then I bought a tricycle and put it there and use the light, etc., etc. So it's totally subjective. This is, well, obviously it's real. I mean, there's no Photoshop manipulation involved, but it's not documentary. And this is my interpretation of the bed and the room in that trailer immediately after they picked up Amber and drove off to the hospital. And again, you see here the use of pink. I've long been struggling with what do I do with the shadow? Should I use a human shadow? But at that point in time, I was still unsure whether it was actually murder and possibly an accident. So I wanted to have a more abstract shadow, which gives a kind of dark atmosphere, but does not point the finger at a human being. Well, maybe we don't have the time to delve into all of that, but I can just briefly say, so this is a hospital room. I went in search of such a hospital room, which had a 1990s atmosphere, based on what Christina told me about her and David waiting in the hospital to see if they could resuscitate Amber. And again, there's this pink flower, which happened to be there. But this is a deserted hospital all the way in the south of Georgia. This is the new jail. In the back of this, Christina was locked up. It's still kind of visual, but this jail is named after the sheriff who arrested her and who, unfortunately for him, died several years afterwards because he was killed by his own lawnmower. Here's an interpretation of the jail cell, which again is not the original jail cell. This is the huge psychiatric institute where Christina was under observation for a couple of weeks to see if she was mentally able to stand trial. And again, I like this confusion. I mean, what you see here is partly real branches and partly just a shadow of branches, which again takes in this what's real, what's unreal, what's real, what's true. And this here, I still have to do a bit of, I have to make a few changes. This is like kind of the bureaucratic monster, which is, puking out is maybe not the word, but exporting the demand for the death sentence. And this finally is a photograph, which again was, this was totally inspired by Christina, who told me at one point that if she would ever get out, she would want to build a small altar for her daughter, for Amber. And she mentioned a few things like the angel and the candle and this locker with Amber's photograph in it. And then I proposed to Christina, well, how about I try to photograph that altar? So we exchanged a bit, and this is the result, you know, where again, you certainly can't see it on screen, but when you look at the flowers, these four flowers, three of them are artificial, or well done, but they're artificial. And the fourth is the real one, which is what's that in English? Well, the one which is dying, basically. Mm-hmm. Again, pink, the 3.5 is referring also to Amber being 3.5 years old when she died. Anyway, so I try to bring layers of the story and of emotional impact into it.
Yeah, very striking images, Jan. Thank you for sharing those.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful pictures, very reminiscent of, you know, the Dutch grandmasters. Indeed.
Yeah, interesting that you say that. Yeah, yeah. Yes.
You're a high-profile, internationally recognised artist. Does that make it easier to overcome some of the barriers that people encounter when they're trying to attract attention to important causes like Christina's?
Yes. Yes, it certainly helps. It basically makes it easier to attract attention in many ways. Some examples. Since I started to actually, let's say, to work as an artivist, meaning to combine making art and trying to get Christina released, that was in May 2018. Since then, I've been in Georgia, I think, 5 or 6 times. And on each occasion, I try to give lectures. So you can imagine it's easier to be invited in, subtly, for example, arts departments of universities there, but even political sciences, journalist education. People take you more seriously, and they assume you have something to say about based on the work I've made. I have relations with media in different countries, and I have a lot of people who like my work. And actually, one of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted to involve more people. Like, to what extent can you turn this into a small movement? because at some point it became clear to me that a lot of people have the urge to do something, to contribute. And what happened was, for example, that after a while, I was contacted by a Dutch radio maker, Katinka Beer, who proposed to make a podcast about it, which she did. And the podcast became a huge success. I mean, within 24 hours after its launch, it was the best, the most popular podcast here in Holland. And a few days later, also in Belgium, which led to TV programs, radio programs in both countries, inviting either us or me to talk about it. But also it led to lots of people emailing me or sometimes phoning me and saying, look, oh, wow, I want to do something. And in the beginning, I didn't really know what to say. I said, like, well, please send Christina a postcard or send her an email or a letter or whatever, because she feels totally forgotten, as in the case of lots of people who've been incarcerated for a long time. They lose the connections, they lose their social network, and after a while, there's hardly anyone who still cares about them. And they feel totally forgotten, and the world will go on without them. So that's what I proposed. But now people have become involved also in organizing lectures. One example last year when she came up for parole again, I just wrote one email to people, let's say in my own network, saying, look, would you be willing to make it clear to the parole board that she does have a support network, that she is not alone, even though it's from abroad, but I mean, people can support her financially, whatever. So the final result was that we had some, I think, 230 people who gave their name, their phone number from, if I'm not mistaken, 15 countries. So we have a famous Dutch writer, a well-known Dutch musician, academics, professors, but also somebody who defined herself as a housewife, a bus driver. So it's I think it's fantastic, absolutely fantastic. From all ranges of society, she gets this support. And recently again, I know by now that in the month in April, when her daughter died, it's always a very difficult period for her. So again, I invited people to, if they felt like it, to write like a support message. And again, there were far over 100 support messages, and we turned them into a little booklet, which we sent and which fortunately even arrived, with the idea that if she feels depressed again and alone again, that she has this booklet and can, like a kind of proof, people at least take the trouble of doing this. They care about me. So I'm not really sure if that's what you were referring to, but yeah, in that sense, it helps. I mean, I do have that network. I have lists of people in different countries. So yeah.
Yeah, you can really hear your kind of like energy around supporting her and thinking, you know, how lucky she is to have somebody who's working that hard to provide with connection, also the support, and trying to challenge her case and thinking how many other people might be in positions like her without that, and how hard that must to have hope and to keep going, really, when faced with all of that.
True. And that is also a point that Christina is making, is, oh my goodness, if they would indeed let me out of prison, that's what I want to become an activist for those people, because they don't have a Jan, and I'm not the only one, mind you, there's lots of other people, and they don't have that. So yeah, you're right.
And Christina's story isn't the only time your work has pursued themes relevant to criminal justice, is it? I mean, you referred to your Law and Order work. How did you become interested in that in the first place?
You could say in the beginning, it was kind of a rational thing. In 2008, I had finished a project which is called Bureaucratics. which is about bureaucracies in 8 different countries all over the world. And then a few years later, I thought, well, now I've basically covered the executive power, but of course we have the, how do you pronounce that in English? Trias politica, is that how you would say it? The executive, the legislative, and the judiciary. So the 3 pillars. And I thought, okay, maybe it's interesting to now delve into the judiciary, which for me translated into how do we, I mean, as a society and as societies, handle crime. So I decided to delve into 3 aspects. The police, which technically is not part of the judiciary, but still, I mean, of course, it's involved in preventing or fighting crime. The courts and the prisons, which in basically all countries in the world, as far as I know, are used as the sanction for committing a crime or supposedly committing a crime. So it started kind of rational, like, okay, let's do that. And again, I benefited, I think, from my own work, because I didn't know anything about law. I studied history, not law. But I found a professor here at the university in Utrecht who was willing to give me private courses in exchange for my books. So we would sit together and he would teach me the basics of international criminal law. And after each session, I would hand him a photo book till the point where he said, well, yeah, I think now you need somebody else to discuss that. And he brought me into contact with one of the Max Planck Institutes in Germany, in Freiburg, which focuses on international criminal law. And that was very interesting. And in fact, the director of that institute wrote an introduction about art and the academic world in the book of Law and Order. So they were very helpful and they gave me a huge stack of literature. And I always want to start a project by reading about it. I don't want to just jump in and not have a clue what it's all about. And of course, also, if you want to make choices, for example, in which countries are you going to do this, then you have to gather knowledge somehow about this whole thing. So anyway, I spent an entire holiday, very luxurious, I have to say, next to a swimming pool, with this huge stack of printed PDFs and articles from the Max Planck Institute. And that just grasped me totally. Unfortunately, I'm not a believer in an afterlife or reincarnation, but otherwise I would plan to become a criminologist in my next life. It's so fascinating. Anyway, so by then it went down from the head to the heart. Advised by this Max Planck Institute, I selected these 4 countries. So there's 2 countries that have systems based on common law, 2 that have systems based on civil law, 2 are have a colonial heritage, 2 are original. In the case of common law, maybe it would have made more sense in a way to start in the UK, but I thought it was a strong argument that a considerable number of states in the US have the death penalty. And again, that's the most radical approach to crime. So anyway, that's how I ended up in the US. And it was really a nightmare to get the permissions. It was just absolutely horrible. But I managed. Sometimes in the case of France, it took me 2 years. In the case of the US, it took me almost 2 years. In the case of Colombia, I never really got what I wanted. And in the case of Uganda, they were as transparent as you can imagine. I could go anywhere, everywhere, where I wanted, which was an interesting surprise.
Yes, an interesting contrast. It was also enjoyable to hear your anecdote about exchanging knowledge for your books, which again is perhaps another example of how being an internationally acclaimed artist opens doorways that other people might not have.
True. Yes, it's true. It makes life easier. Yes. So I do benefit from decades of working in this field. Yeah.
Thank you, Jan. You've mentioned the work which you refer to as the bureaucratics, and I was looking this morning at a picture of a woman sitting at a desk with a mountain of manila folders behind her, which I think was part of that project. And I gather from what you've been saying that this represents some of your thoughts about the executive, I guess. Can you say some more about that project?
Yeah, I can, but let me find the photograph, because that should be very easy, and it's funny, I think. So we have mainly talked about really serious and heavy stuff, but this is kind of funny. So we're not sharing screen now, are we?
Not at the moment, no.
No, okay, let me share that then. Well, where are you?
Yeah, I think we'd planned a conference last year, and we'd invited Jan over to talk about his work, the bureaucratics, because we just thought that would resonate a lot with people who work within the criminal justice system.
Yeah, I bet. Yes.
Well, yes, I mean, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, getting into your remark, David, I guess you could, in a way, call this my revenge on bureaucracy. Because, as you can imagine, with all these difficult topics, I have been struggling with permission so often just to get back to them. Now, I have to say that I did not, I think most of these photos are funny. But I did not try to make a fool of the people involved, but I certainly did try to joke around with the system. I mean, I'm certainly an anarchist at heart, if not more than just at heart. So it was nice to take on this, this part of the political system and to joke around a bit.
And if anyone's listening to this just on audio, it's definitely worth checking out this visual image.
Yeah, it's a whole series. I think all in all, it's 60 or 65 photographs from bureaucrats for example, in India and China and Texas and France and Yemen and Liberia. It's...
And of course, my fantasy is that all the cupboards are empty and all the files are on top of the cupboards here.
that depends on how you look at it. Here, certainly, in some cases, yes. And what in some countries, the higher the position of the bureaucrat, the emptier the cupboards are. And if you're really high, you have nothing because you don't have to work. You're the boss. You are. You don't do. Here, they're empty in the sense that a lot of it has been eaten by rats and mice. And this is not just a metaphor. I mean, at some point, the writer, Will Tindemans, and I were talking to the highest bureaucrat of the state of Bihar in India, the state secretary. And during the conversation, actually, a mouse walked over our shoes. we were very eager to work, much more so than most of these people. So we would ask, what time do you start work? And they would nicely say 9 o'clock. And then you enter the building at 9 o'clock. There's nobody there. I'm not exaggerating. In a corner, for example, there's a dog peeing in one of the offices. And then it's crawling with rats and mice. And by the time people come, of course, they look for cover. But again, this is, of course, the absurdity of rules. I mean, there's a rule that you have to keep these papers for so and so long, but nobody says you have to keep them without them being eaten by rats and mice.
Yeah, we're going to be interviewing shortly David Boyle, the author of Tick Box, which is all about bureaucracy. I'd be really interested to get his perspective on your photos.
I would certainly be interested to hear his comment, yes.
But more recently, Jan, you've been trying to increase traction and work cross-culturally to help societies find more compassionate solutions to criminal justice. Could you tell us a bit about your project, the Holland-America Line?
Yes. I think about 8-9 months ago, I was approached by a fellow photographer who said, there's a guy I've just photographed and I think you have to meet him. He's a retired, just recently retired prison warden. And I think you have to meet. So I went to visit him and this guy is bloody interesting. Well, to mention this one thing which surprised me, and I think I'm not the only one who has some cliches about a prison warden. Well, this guy had been in the municipal council for the left-wing socialist party, which is not my first idea with a prison warden. And interesting also, he's very much against prisons. He considers them to be ridiculous institutes, which are not good, not productive. And we agreed on so many points. And for me, there was this, there was also this idea involved, as I said earlier, I've been giving lectures in the US, in Georgia, on universities, etc. And what I would really like to do is have lectures where you could get local politicians, people working in the prisons, DAs, lawyers, etc., etc. But I thought, yeah, well, I mean, there's this artist who's going to tell those stories. Well, what authority does this guy have? I mean, maybe he makes nice photographs, but is he going to lecture us about our work? That's ridiculous. There's no credibility in that. So when I discovered Frans Dau, this prison warden, and especially after I heard that he was involved in similar situations as I was with Christina. I mean, he has very intense contact with two lifers in the US. I thought, wow, this could be the solution. I mean, if only we can now get lectures or whatever presentations in the US, and there's actually a guy who has decades of practice with prisons. Of course, he has much more credibility. This must be it. So, Corona was already happening, so this is not the ideal time to really do that. But I hope to be in the US again in September. And I hope to be able to set these things up. And so ideas that are going through my head is like, I hope that this exhibition will go to the US. I think it's even more necessary that it gets shown there than it is shown here in Holland. Now, if we could use that exhibition, as we will do here in Holland, as a kind of starting point for presentations, discussions, et cetera, et cetera. And we need this guy, this Frans Dau has to be there. So, so we both, contacted our network. And of course, all these people are ridiculously busy and have little time, but that's okay. I mean, they're willing to collaborate, and we can approach them with practical things. They're not going to be a think tank because they simply don't have the time for that. But if it's like, okay, we need a contact there, or can you introduce us to somebody there, then they are supposedly open to that and helpful. So it's a very informal group of people, which still has to lead to results, and we were waiting for Corona to stop. But let's hope that works out.
It'll be really interesting to see how that pans out with all that energy, with the creativity and the knowledge after the coronavirus pandemic. So we look forward to hearing more about that. But finally, Jan, we're drawing to a close. Now, a lot of your work has involved telling very painful, somewhat traumatic stories, some of which have got very close personal relevance for you. This kind of work is an emotional burden and can take its toll on someone's well-being. How have you managed to protect yourself and keep yourself healthy across such a productive career?
Well, first of all, every once in a while I cry tears. But I think I'm a ridiculously optimistic person. So I think my character just helps. And it is never totally one-dimensional. As I said earlier about Christina, she is such a fascinating person, and she is not just bringing across misery and depression and bad luck. There's a lot of wisdom. There's so much positive energy also coming from her. Or let me give another example. When I was doing this series about comfort women, which is, I don't know if people are familiar with it, but these are women who during the Second World War were forced to basically be sexual slaves for the Japanese army in the occupied areas, in China, Korea, Indonesia, the Philippines, etc. And a little over 10 years ago, together with a writer, I did a project about Indonesian comfort women. So that was very emotional. But even then, there were moments of fun and intimacy. I remember with one of these women who was really my favorite person, we were joking, and this may sound ridiculous, but we were joking about she was going to come to Holland and marry me and stuff like that. I mean, there's always also another side. There's also fun. It's not just simply pure depression, even though in some cases that's the story that comes out of it, because that's what is the topic, what's the subject matter. But in between the lines, there's always other things happening which are nice, and well, given an optimistic nature as I have, I guess you pick up on that.
It was really interesting, I think, to hear you talk about tears, for instance, because I think that's something that doesn't get much spoken about. I think actually about, you know, emotional authenticity does involve allowing yourself to actually feel the feeling, and in order to be able to let it go at times rather than squash it down and pretend it's not happening. But also, it was really nice to hear you talking about the reciprocal, yes, I'm not going to attempt it again. The reciprocal nature of the relationships between you and the people that you're engaging with, and actually about how the enrichment they bring to your life as well. And it's really nice to have that acknowledged. But, you know, it's been so great of you to share so much of your time and to also share your images with us today, and also being willing to be a guinea pig for us on using YouTube for at least one of these podcasts. So thank you so much for everything for today.
You're most welcome, both of you. It was a pleasure talking to you. Good luck with it.
Brilliant. Great to meet you, Jan, and excellent conversation. Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks too to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.